And welcome back, everybody, to Double Down with Russ Lowe. After a little bit of an extended break, I'm thrilled to be back with everybody. And what we always deliver are great guests in the industry of sports betting. And today we've got, direct from the UK, not San Francisco, despite appearances. These days you could be anywhere you want on the internet, which is amazing. But coming from the UK, Mike Adams of Caris Risk. He is the founder and director, and they've been setting betting lines for sportsbooks and also using analytics to support a syndicate to get a little bit of an edge on the book. So playing both sides, it's going to be a fascinating discussion. Mike, thanks for joining the program.
Yeah, fantastic to be here with you, James.
So let's start with the name. It's spelled C-A-E-R-U-S, Caris. Looks like kind of a division from... what's the word I'm looking for? It's too early in the morning here. From Caesar. This has nothing to do with Caesar?
Not Caesar, no, but we went down the maybe not so original path of going through Greek gods to try and find a suitable name for the business. And Caris, if memory serves, is Greek god of luck and fortune, and it seemed like a good one for the industry that we're in. So
okay.
That was the story behind the name.
Shame on me for not knowing that. I certainly should know that.
Your Greek god knowledge is probably about as good as mine. The only knowledge I have is from the research we did. So you're in good company.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Now I'm digging the name. And then you guys were founded in 2020, correct?
Yeah, we've been going around about 4 or 5 years now. The technology, or me and my fellow founder, we actually met about 7 years ago. So the kind of inception of the technology and where it started was then, but as a company, yeah, 4 years.
Okay. And prior to that, you were at Bet365 on the bookmaking side.
Yes. So I'm a well-served veteran of the sportsbook industry. I started my career almost 15 years ago with Bet365. They were a fantastic firm both then and now, gone on to be one of the dominant players in the online market. Moved over to Paddy Power's Australian company, Sportsbet. So I served my time on the trading floor there and then came back to the UK. That was over in Melbourne. Came back to the UK about 5 years ago and have been self-employed and in the industry, kind of carving a path myself ever since.
Bet365 is out of UK, correct?
Yes. Yep. Yeah.
And what are they doing? Remind me what they're doing in the US. Are they partnered with somebody in the US?
Yeah. So they are present in the US. I don't know the volume of states that they're in at the moment, but they're not as aggressive, shall we say, when entering new territories like the Flutters of this world with the FanDuel acquisitions. And 365 tends to just try and grow organically in these regions as opposed to acquisitions. They're still a privately held company, and that gives them a kind of global competitive edge, I suppose, without the need to acquire.
So were you in the business of setting the lines? Is that what you were doing while you were at Bet365? You were doing the analytics of that?
Yeah, at 365, I was I started on the graduate scheme in the sports book. So I saw all facets of sports bookmaking, I suppose, which gave me a great foundation. Obviously, part of that was odds making and line setting and the trading side of things. And then when I moved over to Sportsbet, that was purely trading floor roles that I served there across a number of different sports as well. So I got a good visibility of horse racing, tennis, soccer, all the facets of modeling different sports.
Uh-huh. So how are the books doing these days? You know, it's my understanding some of them are setting their own lines to start, right? Others are outsourcing it to a third-party company. So was Bet365 doing it themselves?
Yeah, they're one of the few firms that still do a lot of in-house trading and will do some line creation themselves. The misconception about bookmakers these days, you know, like you've alluded to, the majority are using third-party suppliers for their pricing feeds, whether it's one of the major suppliers to give them that managed trading service, or whether they're taking the price feed and doing some of their trading and risk management on top of that. But these days, outside of maybe 365, Flutter still do things in-house, and a few of the other big firms, but yeah, the majority are, for all intents and purposes, marketing and customer retention companies as opposed to trading companies.
Yeah, and you mentioned before we started that right now Caris also provides lines or information anyway to syndicates, to people on the betting side. And correct me if I'm wrong, the analysis is basically the same. If you're someone who's going to be setting a line if you're a company that's going to set a line for a Bet365 or for a FanDuel, et cetera, the analysis you're going to go through is pretty similar to the analysis that any syndicate would do, a bettor in analyzing a game and deciding whether or not he's going to play one side or the other relative to the line. Is that, would you agree with that?
Yes, yeah,
Yes.
exactly that. So the process to modeling the prediction of a sporting event is the same regardless of which side that you sat on of that bookmaking fence. How you would use that information. So the output of the modeling process is what we would determine as a fair price, right? What do we believe is the true percentage of the outcome of this event? Now, how you would use that information would be different if you're a sports book and making a market around that information compared to if you're a syndicate trying to take a value price around that information. But yeah, you're exactly right that the process is the same.
Right. And walk us through that process. What is, you're about to set a line. You guys are doing primarily soccer right now?
Exactly. We're 100% soccer at the moment. So our expertise over these last few years has been built around the modeling of soccer and the various different outcomes around that, whether it's player performance, player props, or yeah, the match, who wins the match, how many goals are.
Right. So walk us through, Liverpool versus Manchester matchup, and where exactly you guys start is in the process of creating a line for that game.
Yeah, it's a really good question, and I'll try not to bore the audience by going too technical on it. So, from a very high level, there's kind of three elements of inputs to the modeling process. So, we would look at what the teams have done historically. So, at the team level, right, what were their previous performances like? Who did they play? How strong were the teams that they performed against? What were the lineups? Who was in, who was out, and what was the true strength of those historical performance, and how does that translate to a projected rating? Then we've got what we would term as a bottom-up approach, where we look at the players only. So we kind of take what they did on the pitch and then model that. So that's getting quite complex, and there's a lot of machine learning that goes into that player model. And then the third element is external variables. So these are things that influence the performance of a team that's outside of the two teams. So where did they play? Was there a crowd, a home crowd in attendance? How far did the teams travel to get to that stadium? What was their schedule like going into that game? So there's all these variables that will impact performance, and they are in the model as well.
Yeah, I just listened to the Billy Walters book. Have you listened or read that book?
Fantastic. Yeah, I have
Yeah.
read that, like about 90% of the betting population, I think.
So what he describes as far as what he used to do, his syndicate in betting, and he claims that he was profitable for like 22 straight years. I don't know if anybody's out there doubting that or not, but that's what he claims. And it was pretty much going through the process that you just articulated. But I guess, a question for you about Billy, since you've also, read the book, what wasn't everybody pretty much doing it the way that he described?
Yeah, the processes will be very similar because there's a piece at the end of his book that talks about some of the quantifies some of the things they were doing, like player values, what's a strong quarterback in, out, how many points is that worth? So it's the same methodology across all team sports, right? You're trying to determine how strong an entity is, like a team made up of individuals, and then you need to know how much does each individual relatively contribute to that strength. So there's a lot of similarities across pricing up, basketball, NFL, football, team sports where they're opposing each other, and you need to know the distribution of their points for and against. So yeah, a lot of
Yeah.
similarities.
Now, was he perhaps ahead of his time, though? Is that perhaps why he was so successful and now the books have caught up to doing it the way he's doing it?
Yeah, I mean, everything evolves. So there's a couple of ways to get an edge, and one of them is to be first. So if you're doing something before others are doing it, that definitely gives you an edge over the market.
Right. But now, I mean, sports betting is getting so mature now, exponentially mature. It would seem hard to believe that somebody could come up with something new today that would be better than what was out there. I mean, obviously we have AI, and I'm sure that's probably already playing a role. But is that kind of the final missing piece to figuring this out, is applying AI to this?
Yeah, well, one of the reasons that we've got into the B2B services, that bookmakers, it's not a primary cause of theirs to get the most efficient line. To being a bookmaker, to maximize your revenue on turnover, often the optimal position to be with your odds is middle of the market. So there's no incentive for the books to kind of accurately price from the start. The market is driven by the few sharp books that are out there that have a slightly different business model. You might have heard of Pinnacle. They're kind of the leading sharp book. They have a different business model to the FanDuels and DraftKings of this world because they operate off high turnover, low margin, and they accept winning business, whereas the FanDuels and DraftKings of this world try and restrict that winning business. So there's not a lot of incentive for the broader bookmaking market to kind of focus on having the best models to create the best price initially. They're more focused on building models that create more product. So we see same game parlays, models to engines to drive those type of products for the bookmakers. That's where their investment in modeling goes.
And just like AI seems poised to take a bunch of people's jobs in so many different industries, I presume you see that we're probably not very far away from AI taking away positions and people setting opening lines, that it could be done 100% through AI?
Yeah, and technology just allows greater scale, really. So there's always going to be, well, I'll say always, we won't go on that long of a timeline, but in the immediate future, there's a human element to determine what features go into like a machine learning model and where the AI kind of looks, I suppose. They'll never be, again, I'll refrain from saying that never, but in the immediate term, there's not perfect models. So if a model has a bias that you need to correct over time for whatever reason, or there's a inaccuracy in the data that's causing that bias, there's an element of human interaction to drive the models or keep reinforcing the learning of the models. But you're certainly right. If we go on a long enough timeline, I'm sure that we'll all be out of a job.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's take a break. I'm sure AI is actually picking up and conducting interviews too. So, I'll be out of a job too. So, it's all happening very, very quickly. But for now, we're still here, and we'll be back right after these messages with Mike Adams, founder and director of Caris Risk on Double Down with Russ.
The world's best-known investor and Wall Street expert, Warren Buffett, once said, "Wall Street is the only place that people ride to in a Rolls-Royce to get advice from those who take the subway." Mr. Buffett's quote is remarkably accurate, but how many people would rather receive advice from him than someone simply guessing? Welcome to Buy, Hold, Sell, your single source for Wall Street knowledge and profitable guidance. Please join me, Todd Schoenberger, and fellow trader Tobin Smith, as well as host Veronica Dudo, for a podcast known to move the needle for investors. Tobin and I are seasoned Wall Street executives with deep investment experience, and we are prepared to share our advice to those who choose to listen. Download Buy, Hold, Sell today on the Evergreen Podcast Network or your favorite podcast channel.
Hi, it's Lauren the Better, and you're listening to Double Down with Breslow on the Evergreen Podcast Network.
And welcome back, everybody. Double Down with Breslow. We are talking with Mike Adams, founder and director of Caris Risk. We've been talking about setting lines for books, and I thought you made a really interesting point there that you don't necessarily want your line to be too good because it needs to be in line with where the betting public is going to be. If you're talking about your typical sports book, the ideal line for them is the line that gets bets on either side, right? 50-50. They don't want the line to move because now they're opened up to risk that they could get middled, right? Whereas somebody who's on the betting side with a syndicate or betting on their own, et cetera, they want the actual number. They don't want it influenced by, where the betting public is going to be. So is that what essentially creates the delta then that allows syndicates to perform well and actually make money in sports betting, despite the fact that most people think it's not possible to make money in sports betting?
Yeah, so there's a couple of things to unpick there. So at the beginning, that's balancing the book is potentially not, or in some cases, not the optimal way for a sports book to price. Because if they are looking to maximize their return on turnover, essentially they want to sell the most popular selection at the shortest possible price. So the middle of the market doesn't necessarily mean the point where you would want to balance turnover on both sides. It's more, right, where can we sell the most popular selection for the cheapest price. And there's some very large turnover events. So inevitably, most markets are driven by those sharp books, the Pinnacles of this world, and the soft books will kind of follow that price because otherwise, like you said, they're going to get arbed. There'll be arbitrage opportunities that sharper punters will exploit. There are some very large liquid events like the Mayweather-McGregor fight a few years ago, which is often referenced in these kind of examples, where there's so much recreational volume that outweighs any kind of sharp activity, and there can be this lopsided book because the soft bookmakers are able to sell McGregor at a cheaper price than what he is, because that's where all the weight of money was. The World Cup, you will sometimes see those kind of examples as well. Yeah, I mean, you could write textbooks and essays about the most efficient bookmaking price to maximize turnover. It's maximize revenue. It's a complex topic.
Because all of this gets pretty complex as I'm realizing. For instance, sharp book was not a term that I was familiar with until you use it. So
Yeah, so
help
I think
explain me. So that,
in the
yeah, I want to
US,
make sure
maybe
I
it's
understand
the
what you mean by that.
oh, sorry. Yeah, maybe it's the kind of wise guys is the equivalent. So it's a bookmaker that would take wise guy action and not close those accounts.
Gotcha. And does that also mean so a sharp book is not super focused on being balanced? Is that kind of the point?
Well, they're just reacting based on turnover, based on bets that they take. Whereas a soft book, so if a sharp book takes a wise guy bet, they're going to move the price. A soft book won't move the price just on the bets that they take. They would rather identify the wise guys and kick them out. It's just a different business model. It's not right or wrong. It's just a different model.
And do they typically have higher bet limits?
Because they need to solicit that action. So yeah, higher limits for those wise guys anyway.
And again, they don't need to, they won't lay off action. You're saying they will move the line based on action that they've gotten on one side or the other. But ultimately, is it important for them to be balanced on both sides, or that they're less concerned about that than a typical book?
No, they're just looking to get to, they're going to use that action to get to what the market says is the correct price. And then hopefully their business model is such that their limits will be the biggest at that point, which is inevitably close to when the event starts. And then they'll do enough turnover at those bigger limits, enough handle at those bigger limits to actually make a small margin, despite loot potentially having negative margin, losing to those wise guys that first hit that line and kind of knocks it into shape. So that would be the price life cycle, I suppose.
One thing I've always been curious about is why there doesn't seem to be more competition when it comes to the house edge, the juice, the 110 to win 100, as opposed to 108 or 106 to win 100, et cetera. I mean, I guess the first question is, am I right that there isn't much competition out there on that? That most of them seem just to be sticking to the 110, and if so, why?
The why, so I'm not too familiar with price dynamics in the US market at the moment. There might be some price competition I'm not familiar with, but the why I can certainly have a go at answering. The majority of recreational bettors, normal bettors that look into bet their team or bet a parlay at the weekend, they're not price sensitive. So their incentive for betting, the logic that they go through to determine a bet and the decision making to strike that bet, price plays a very small, if any, kind of element in that. It's more about what they can win or what their opinion is of the outcome, and having that dopamine hit, that emotional investment in, right, I've determined I think this is going to happen and I'm going to invest in it. I was privy to some fantastic analysis at Sportsbet, where we actually identified that sometimes customers are inversely price sensitive, and by that they are more akin to betting a price that they're familiar with, even if it's shorter. So if you put minus 110 two sides, you might get more action than minus 108 both sides, because people are more familiar with minus 110.
Interesting. So it sounds like you're saying that, yeah, theoretically, a book could change it to 108, giving the player just a little bit better edge, and the book could do just fine. Obviously, it's cutting into margins a little bit, but they would do just fine. It's just that they don't need to.
Yeah, exactly. It's not going to drive the additional handle to pay for that diminished margin. And actually, one of the big areas that bookmakers focus on is generosity. So it's using the, the 110 both sides, the margin they make, and giving back overtly to customers from that, whether it's bonus bets, price increases, boost, odds boosts, as they call them, or other incentives that allow them to better showcase generosity as opposed to it being in the price.
One of the biggest developments of sports betting, it seems to me, is going from simply betting on the outcome of the game to all the players and all kinds of different stuff that can be bet on, right? I mean, in a typical soccer game going on in the UK, Liverpool versus Manchester, the Super Bowl used to be infamous for having all kinds of crazy extra bets, but now it seems just about every game's got all kinds of crazy extra bets, including on individual players. I mean, in a typical soccer game, how many different bets are being offered by the big books?
Yeah, dependent on which soft book you go to, which sports book you go to, but there's some books I will navigate to that have up to 5,000 different lines to bet, and that's every permutation of every market that you could potentially conceive that is actually a worthwhile proposition to bet. So you're right, that kind of depth is huge these days.
So as a gambler, and you say you've dabbled or continue to dabble, isn't that where potentially opportunity lies? Because when you're setting 5,000 different lines on a single game, each one of them's got to be a solid line.
Yeah, exactly. And you'll find that bookmakers reflect that uncertainty in the overround, the margin that they will charge. So particularly things like same game parlays, where you've got multiple events, selections within that bet that might all be independently quite low confidence markets. And to cover that or allow for that, there's a lot more margin that's built in for the bookmakers. So yeah, you're 100% right that that uncertainty abounds in those derivative markets, and just additional margin is the way the books will manage that these days.
Yeah, and also the likelihood of some type of corruption comes in big time when it's not just, it used to be about, oh, could one player influence the outcome of the game, be paid off, and this and that, but when you're betting on how many assists a basketball player is going to have, or how many yards running, a running back in the NFL is going to have, I mean, they have 100% control of that outcome in their own hands. So the risk just goes through the roof based on this type of betting.
Yeah, with the market depth certainly heightened, and I believe there was a case in basketball recently, wasn't there? I think the benefit of more regulated markets, so the US now being regulated compared to before PASPA was repealed, there's the benefits of the visibility and surfacing of irregular betting patterns that help to actually eliminate these kind of cases, as opposed to if it was purely an offshore market and these actual propositions were still being offered, but there wasn't the regulation and the integrity units to actually deal with this kind of risk.
Yeah. Well, I guess that's a question is, where would the bets take place? If there was some type of a, inside job being conducted, would they be placing their bets with the legal sports books, or which have probably generally pretty low maximum bets, right? Or would they be betting them offshore anyway?
Yeah, that's a good question. I believe the recent case was a regulated book, wasn't it? For relatively large stakes. So, but I don't know too many specific details about that case.
And what was that? That was in the US?
Yeah, there's a basketball player. The name does escape me, but it was a few weeks ago. It made the headlines. He's betting on unders in his one of his props, or someone connected to him. Sorry.
Oh, I see. He was betting. They caught the guy betting on himself.
I believe unders on one of his props, yeah, but don't
Wow.
quote me on the name.
Wow.
I'll have to share the story
What I
after.
mean, what is your belief as to how much of that might be actually going on? I'm not talking about a player just trying to make money, but I'm talking about a player being paid off to, throw a tennis match or throw a over under on yards in a game, et cetera. Do you have any feel for to what extent this is going on out there?
Yeah, there's some really good integrity reports, particularly in soccer, that we have visibility of. And given the volume of events and the volume of markets that take place each year, the percentage is very, very low. You're talking below, 0.2% of events. And most of those tend to be lower grade events. So whether it's youth level, like under 23, should say, that kind of level, or very amateur lower leagues where there's low remuneration for players and there's that additional incentive. Certainly at the top and professional levels, the prevalence in soccer at least is very, very limited.
Yeah, I've heard some rumors about things happening in, kind of third world country kind of stuff, right? Where like you said, it's all about how much the players get paid. If they're not getting paid enough, then they're susceptible to it. And right now, the money in US and European professional sports is pretty significant, make it pretty hard to pull it off.
Yeah, exactly that. So yeah, it's something that's existed since sports existed. I think there was a Baseball World Series 100 or so years ago, wasn't there? That yeah, famously was a fixing event.
I
So
think it was
unfortunately,
it
yeah.
Todd's old enough to remember that. He maybe he'll pipe in with that. It was the Black Sox scandal. Like some reason 1908 is the date that rings a bell. Did you see that movie? It's a pretty good movie.
So it sounds about right, the date. I'll have to catch the movie. You'll have to send me the name after the
Oh
call.
yeah. No, it's a John Cusack, I remember, was one of his first films. Shoeless Joe Jackson was kind of the famous player involved. He was like the best player in all of baseball, but he was part of throwing, I mean, of all things, the World Series.
World
But
Series, yeah.
yeah, I think the backstory is they were pissed off at the owner because he was underpaying all of them to begin with, and this was an opportunity to get back at him.
Sounds like a good
Cool.
movie,
Well,
though.
no, it's I forget the name of it, but anyway, Black Sox scandal. If you look up the movie, you'll find it. All right, Mike. Well, let's wrap up there. Anything else you'd like to share for people to know? Find your company, etc.
Website is kerisrisk.com, .co.uk, sorry, and you can find us on LinkedIn as well. Just put in the same name, Keris, on LinkedIn to get in touch.
Nice. And you guys got people working for you in the States also, or just everybody's in the UK?
Yeah, our CTO is actually in the US, so he's based out of New York. We're a remote first company, so we've got guys all over the place, from Mexico to the Philippines. We're pretty global at the moment.
Yeah, awesome. Okay, Mike Adams, founder and director of Keris Risk. Thank you so much for joining Double Down, and thank you all for listening and watching. We'll be back soon with another great episode. Take care, everyone.